Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. We're up and running for an all-new year of shows, and it feels good to be back. There's been a few big developments just today in the world of Star Trek news. When I'm recording this, the first promotional image for Star Trek Prodigy has been released, and it's weird, like in a good way. It's a line of presumably the main characters of Prodigy, the new animated series on Nickelodeon, and I don't recognize any of these aliens. There's not a Cardassian or an Andorian in sight. So I'm wondering, where does this show take place? Is this maybe set in another part of the galaxy, or maybe outside the galaxy? Who can say? We've also got word that new seasons of Discovery, Lower Decks, and the first season of Prodigy will all release this year, meaning if you thought 23 weeks of Trek was an achievement, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's not all the news. There's also been some announcements about upcoming changes for Paramount Plus and new shows, a Frasier reboot on Paramount Plus. There you go. We'll definitely be having a new show roundup in the near future. But in the meantime, you can always follow us on Twitter at EISTpod or on Facebook at Enterprising Individuals for news and updates. I got a treat for you this week. On last week's show, I talked with Darren Mooney of The Escapist about the original series episode, The Immunity Syndrome, and about Darren's history with Trek. At least, that's what you heard if you listened to the show. What you didn't hear is nearly an hour of additional conversation between myself and Darren about a variety of topics. We're both Doctor Who fans, and we chatted about the Who franchise across the years. We also talked in more depth about a variety of nerdy topics, and we had an extended discussion about Star Trek Discovery, which I had to cut because it was technically off topic, but it serves really well as a third and final act of our discussion last week about the evolution of Trek over the years. Darren is a man who knows his Trek and he can hold forth on it, a man my own father called a fire hose of topical synthesis, and it killed me to cut anything, but writing and indeed editing is sometimes about killing your babies. But there's good news. All is not lost, and nothing is lost. I sweep up all those gems from the cutting room floor, tape them back together, and present them to you every week on our Patreon at patreon.com/EISTPOD. We call it Live Gah. It's outtakes and extra content from our episodes, and it's always available to crew members on our Patreon. For as little as $1 a month, you can become a crew member of the show and get access to bonus content, be it Doctor Who related or not. Live shows, commentary tracks, and sneak peeks at upcoming episodes and more, all available at patreon.com/EISTPOD. Check it out. But first, stick around because we are presenting some live gah today. The rest of my conversation with Darren Mooney is available for free right now, right here, as well as on our Patreon. So stay tuned for more of Darren Mooney and take a drink from the fire hose. That's it for me this week. Don't forget to follow us online or stop by our Discord, link in the show notes, and say hello. We'll be back next week. Enjoy the rest of the interview. And with that, let's get underway. Enterprise, for me, I'd never seen the series end-to-end all the way through before, and I'm actually doing it now, and I'm experiencing that same thing, having just a real strong like first season and a kind of setup of what it was going to be, and yeah, it gets soft in the second season. There's a couple real clunkers, and you wonder where they're going, and then when they take off on this really serialized arc, you know, into the Expanse and then onward from there. It's almost for me, I know that serialized storytelling is almost de rigueur now, especially with streaming shows, where every show starts with a previously on, and yeah. Then we go and we look at all the important plot points. But it's almost like perfect. It's almost just enough. They'll do a little bit. They'll be in a new area. And then somebody will mention, remember the time that the Zindi did this and we got that? And it's like, oh, I remember that because it was four episodes ago, not like 4 years ago. Yeah. And I just think that that's almost the exact amount of serialization that I want. As far as like previous Treks, especially TNG, as you mentioned, hardly any at all. But I think that, like, the spacing almost worked well, too, because you'd have, like, a, say, one Klingon episode every year, and then you would be, you have that moment where you have to be like, okay, Worf, what happened last time with Worf? Okay, that's right. he was kicked out of the Klingon Empire. Okay, now he's dealing with that. And almost the sort of set free, very non-modern, sort of just day-to-day storytelling of their of TNG kind of made some of the moments work better. Like you mentioned, the development of Riker as a character over the long arc of the season or the series. He would do things in like season six where, for instance, like when Thomas Riker comes on board and you think, oh, I know what Riker's going to do. And he has a much more mature thing. And you almost look back and go, oh, he really has grown. Yeah. And the show isn't telling me like week to week, like, you know, you've really grown, Riker. All good things, like the way that it ends with Picard coming to the poker game. And you realize, I've watched this show for 7 years and never really thought about the fact that Picard has never sat down and played poker with these people. And the way that they pay off those moments were really great. So, I mean, I could argue either way, you know, for just them being standalones or being just one long arc. Although it does seem like one long arc is the only way to do it now.
Yeah. And I will say, actually, to give the third season of Enterprise credit, I also think that while it does have that one long arc, particularly in the second half of the season, even if you look at like the standalone episodes in the third season, and they're the ones I think are really underrated, where there feels like there's a genuine kind of new energy kind of pushing towards it. A real sense of, again, it happens with shows when it's like nobody's watching. Dad's not in the room anymore. We can do what we want. And it's like you can see like David A. Goodman being fine. We're doing a space western with Glenn Morshower. It's like, yeah, I want to see that. Or it's like, right. Or even like, oh, we're doing Beauty and the Beast, but it's going to be super creepy. And it's like, yeah, I'm in with that too as well.
Yeah.
Like you get this kind of like real, because I think, you know, again, sorry, not to turn this into a discussion of like Enterprise as a microcosm.
Oh, no.
But I think when you get to the second season of Enterprise, it's what really, really, really killed the second season of Enterprise for me when I was watching it was this sense of dull repetition. I had seen all of this stuff before. Like they do the Magnificent Seven with the Klingons, and it's like, oh, I already saw the Magnificent Ferengi and it was much better. They do, I think, Dawn with Trip, and it's like, oh yeah, but Darmok was the same thing, but was also much better. They do The Crossing and it's like, yeah, but I saw Return to Tomorrow, you know, back in the 60s, and that was also much better than this. And they just keep reiterating these. I think at one point they do Judgment, which is great. I actually really love Judgment, but it's also, I saw Star Trek VI. I've seen this before. Whereas when you get to like season three, there's a real sense of, okay, fine, we're going to let the nerds run the asylum. We're going to let the guys on the writing staff who have like wanted to write Star Trek and have thought really hard about what they love about Star Trek and are just going to let them free with no expectation of, well, it has to be like TNG. Because like I love TNG. As I mentioned, I came up with TNG. But with the Berman era, you have that period where it just runs through TNG. And like I would argue, and again, I love TNG, and I particularly think the seventh season is massively underrated in terms of its weirdness.
Yeah.
It's not a great season of television with great episodes in it, but it's a refreshingly odd season of television, particularly when you watch it in a big chunk. But like you go from that into Voyager, and you go from Voyager into the first two seasons of Enterprise, and it's like by that stage you're like, dude, I think I've had enough TNG. I didn't think I'd reach capacity. If you'd asked me, like, at All Good Things, would I like seven more years of this? I probably would have said, yeah, sure, bring it on.
Yeah.
But now I'm like, no. I feel like we've reached maybe capacity. Maybe we can do something else. Try something a bit new, I think.
Yeah. Voyager, you know, I just binged Voyager recently, and it was the same thing where it's like, okay, TNG plot, TNG plot, TNG plot. And often do it, you know, TNG, the crew of the Enterprise D, Picard are making hard choices. Often on Voyager, they would make like the opposite choice or like a choice that I would, you know, label objectively as wrong, but without the kind of justifications that you would get from Picard explaining how this is, you know, the important thing for the Prime Directive or for this society or whatever. They would just do something weird. And it's like, oh, okay, that's what you want to do. I don't know.
Like, again, I kind of watched Voyager because I watched all of Star Trek, and like watching Voyager did kind of sap my enthusiasm. I think it took me like a year to do like the reviews of the seventh season of Voyager. One of my favorite, like one of my favorite big kind of Voyager, like illustrations of like, again, my issues. I know people love Voyager and there are some fantastic episodes in Voyager. There are episodes that I would rank among the very best of the franchise. And I mean, obviously the ones that everybody mentions, but I think even Child's Play from the sixth season is like Darren's underrated Star Trek Voyager episode, if you want a deep cut there.
Yeah.
But I think that like, if you were to say, if you were to kind of like, if you wanted a Voyager problem in a microcosm, like I remember Night, the fifth season premiere.
Sure.
And like in it, that episode's about the Melon and they're coming through the wormhole and they're just dumping out crap all over the place. It's meant to be a big, gritty environmental parallel. And it's meant to be like, oh my God, as a developed culture, we should maybe think about the way that we consume and the way that we produce waste, because that waste is just being taken to the developed world. It's being sent to these big dumps. It's polluting. It's killing things. This is a really horrible, like, ethical dilemma for us to wrestle with.
Yeah.
And then about halfway through the episode, Chakotay takes the Melon down to the engineering section. It's like, oh, by the way, we invented this magic technology which will completely reduce your waste altogether. It'll solve your waste problem. Won't be any need for you to dump and kill the native population. There won't be any need for you to expose your kind of staff to radiation, which is clearly disfiguring you. And we will give it to you for free with no cost whatsoever. Which, by the way, breaks the entire metaphor or any kind of weighty choice. And I love that, like, with 20 minutes left to go on the episode, the Melon captain goes, nah, I really just like being evil.
Yeah. I love dumping waste. Keep your magic technology.
Yeah, because it's like his rationale is, yeah, but if you do that, then I'll go out of business. Yeah. And it's like, no, you idiot. Chakotay's offering you a freaking monopoly.
Yeah. I'm like... Yeah, we can understand a parable about environmentalism, but the real parable is about capitalism. You know, how Chakotay wouldn't even think to destroy an entire industry because who cares? But the show and the franchise itself, it never really wants to tackle that.
yeah.
But I do have something about that later, so I want to save my discussion about that.
And it's kind of interesting to write about pop culture in the year that has been. So I started on the site in late 2019, and obviously constant churn of pop culture.
Yeah.
Constant churn, like, you know, again, anybody, this is weird because earlier in this podcast, I was like, you remember people who are old enough to remember VHSs. And now I'm like, people who are old enough to remember cinemas. So like in 2019, it was around the kind of peak content era. So you would have... Every week you would have like new big blockbusters in cinemas. Every week you would have new shows coming to streaming. You would have this constant stream of events that you could write about. So I could write about, you know, the new season of Star Trek Discovery is coming. So that's this week. Or there's a new announcement about a new Star Wars movie. So that's this week as well. Or, you know, I saw this cool new little indie Western. I'm going to write about that for this week as well. And then obviously, you know, I mean, last year in around about March 2020, like everything else on the planet, pop culture just kind of stopped. Now, yeah. You know, I mean, admittedly, there's been like streaming service releases. There've been movies on streaming services. You know, big ones like, say, Mulan, for example. There have been a couple of releases in cinemas like Tenet. There's the whole thing with HBO going kind of direct to digital and sort of, you know, the release of Wonder Woman and stuff like that. But like, by and large, there hasn't been as much culture, which has been kind of great and terrifying in a sense that, you know, I have to write, you know, 3,000 words every week about pop culture in a pop culture that isn't necessarily moving forward in a way that kind of arguably supports that. So it's given me the opportunity to do really interesting stuff that I'm kind of really proud of, and to delve in and to kind of dive deep and to take a look back at stuff. And, you know, could I go back and look at, you know, movies that maybe other people haven't seen? Like, for example, I think Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale, which was an Australian Western that was relatively underseen. But I was able to do a column on that, which I really loved and was really proud of. Or take a look back and kind of write about The Terminator as a subversive slasher movie from 1984. Just kind of dive into all this stuff.
And skip instead to talking about an article that you wrote recently called Despite the Outrage, Doctor Who is Less Woke Than It's Been in Decades, continuing on the idea of a culture war. And I won't, you know, go through the whole piece, but I guess I wanted to ask you that if you think, you called out specifically that, of course, there's an increase in representation from, say, I don't know, the Tom Baker era or whatever, but the way that the stories play out, the way that the Doctor responds to characters that are clearly stand-ins for real world institutions or people like Donald Trump or Amazon are not particularly revolutionary. And it all kind of culminates, at least for me, in the episode Rosa, where Doctor Who meets Rosa Parks, the important figure in civil rights history in America. And I was dissatisfied in the way that that episode sort of played out, and the Doctor's just involvement period in that episode I found very strange. And I wonder if you think that Doctor Who formula, that idea of the Doctor going back, and it's fine for them to meet George Washington or Mrs. O'Leary's cow or what have you, but do you think that Doctor Who should be playing in these areas that are specifically about race and race relations, you know, like within the 20th century.
So just to kind of like bring it back.
That's a big question.
It absolutely is a big question. And I worry that the podcast is going to run even longer. And I apologize to listeners if I do go on about it. But it's a very valid question. I think it's a very interesting question. And I think this gets into like one of the challenges when you're doing something like Doctor Who, where the core concept of Doctor Who is the character has a time machine and they can use it to travel in time. And again, the idea was originally that it would be used to teach children about history and to teach them about science. And, you know, therefore the first Doctor would routinely like go and he'd meet Marco Polo and he'd have adventures. And sure, some of the content would be vaguely racist, but it was the 1960s and we didn't worry too much about such things. Sure. And things like brown face don't look as striking in black and white as they do when you do them in color. Or like during the Tom Baker era, but that's a separate discussion and we're not going to get into that right now.
Right.
But what happens is, like, as the show evolves, the Doctor, and particularly like almost immediately with the introduction of the Daleks, it stops being an educational show. The Doctor stops being the guy who teaches you about history so you can pass your test when you sit your GCSE or whatever. Mm-hmm. He starts being kind of a proactive, heroic figure. And again, he does that in the second serial, The Daleks, where it's like, okay, the Daleks are monsters and the Doctor has to fight them. And it happens again with the second Doctor, where when Terry Nation takes his Daleks and wants to take them to the US and wants to sell the rights to a Dalek TV show, which I still can't wrap my head around as something that people would want to buy, but apparently that was something in the like 60s. But while he did that, they invented the Cybermen. And like in the Cybermen, the second Doctor kind of like, I think it's the moon base. It might be the moon base where the second Doctor has this big speech about how, oh, there are dark corners of the universe where the most vile things exist and lurk in shadow and evil must be fought. And that's kind of what my character does now. And at that point, it becomes very, very difficult to have the character like travel back in time and meet these characters without interacting with them or without expressing a moral opinion on them. And again, sorry if I'm going into too much history here, but it's notable that like the second Doctor is the point at which the straight historical died. The idea of the Doctor traveling back in time and meeting people of interest from the past died with the second Doctor. After that, it became the Doctor travels through history. He meets a person from the past and there's a monster there and he has to fight the monster and beat the monster. And that's basically what happens. And it becomes like an archetype. And obviously, like, you know, Doctor Who fans who are listening to this podcast, hello, all three of you, are waving their fists in the air going, what about Black Orchid? And I'm like, yes, there are exceptions, but as a trend and as a rule, that's generally what happens. Yeah. And again, if you even look at, say, the new series, you look at things like, say, when the 10th Doctor, the character played by David Tennant, met Queen Victoria, it was a werewolf story. When the 9th Doctor met Charles Dickens, it was a ghost story.
Right.
And I think that, like, that exposes kind of the limit in the show's kind of format in that sense, in that, like, the Doctor has become a proactive figure, for better or for worse. He lands in a place. That description of him, I think, River Song gives. I think in the Pandorica opens, I might be wrong, this isn't a Doctor Who podcast, I didn't do my research properly for it, I apologize. But the idea of, like, the idea that the Doctor crashes in a box and tears down your world and dismantles it and hops in a box and flies away. The Doctor lands in a world where children are crying, and he tears down the world so that those children don't have to cry anymore. That's basically the Doctor's function, historically speaking. And I think, and this is where it gets kind of interesting, where I couch my criticism in praise and I kind of temper my praise with criticism when I say that I admire in theory what I suspect the Chibnall era is trying to do with Doctor Who. In large part because it is trying to return the show back to its 60s roots. And again, this isn't just in terms of storytelling, in terms of like making it an educational show. This is in terms of like its storytelling and structure. So if you look at things like, say, the second episode, The Ghost Monument, that is very much a riff on, say, a Terry Nation script, which is something like, say, The Keys of Marinus. Oh, you actually know Doctor Who. This is fantastic. Sorry, I didn't realize you're also a Doctor Who nerd. This is fantastic. I feel less bad about boring your ear off or bending your ear off. So The Keys of Marinus, which is where Terry Nation does like lots of boring world building. It's like, oh yeah, and the seas are made of acid, and that's important because we're going to spend 30 minutes here. And then when you look at like The Ghost Monument, it's like, oh, the seas are made of acid, but that doesn't matter because we only have 40 minutes to get to the end of the story anyway. So it's just superfluous detail. It's completely unnecessary and it doesn't add to the plot in any way whatsoever. And this is not how television works in 2017. But the problem is that like you look at, say, what Chibnall's trying to do in terms of kind of theme with these historicals, where he wants to turn Doctor Who into a show that is about the importance of witnessing and about the importance of watching. And again, this is the idea of like, going back to the very first episode of Doctor Who, if you watch it, watch how the First Doctor explains the concept of the TARDIS to Ian Chesterton. Mm-hmm. Ian Chesterton says, this is impossible. This is so much bigger on the inside. How are you able to fit an entire room inside a box? And the Doctor's response is to say, well, I mean, you have television, right? You can fit an entire skyscraper on that box. So the TARDIS has always been kind of comparable to television and the idea of kind of watching. And what I admire about like what Chibnall's trying to do is he seems like he's trying to return to that. And I think there's an argument you can make in favor of that. And that argument is you look at things like, say, the emergence of social media, and you look at things like the importance of social media in giving a voice to marginalized communities, in like allowing videos and footage and firsthand witness accounts of terrible things happening. And you think of like historically, look at things like, say, the Arab Spring in the 2010s, where a lot of that information was circulated via videos and via reports on social media and getting the word out and getting people interested and invested and actually helping spur that kind of movement, whatever unfortunately may have happened at the end of it. But even like you look at things like, say, recent stuff that happened in the States and in the UK around police brutality, where because people are now carrying phones with them all the time, they can record these terrible things as they're happening and share them. And people can share collectively in the rage and the anger and the experience of it. People watching those videos can go, I had never thought about what it was like to be an African American in a heavily policed country like this, because I'd never seen it before. I had never witnessed it on video. I had never observed it. And I think to give the Chibnall era credit, it is arguably making a point similar to that, where the Doctor is transformed into a figure who witnesses instead of acts. And again, this idea of listening, which is interesting. Now, again, the idea that it's the first female Doctor is the Doctor who listens is perhaps a little bit problematic in terms of gender roles. Well, and I don't know how much time we have to go into that.
Yeah.
But what I will say, I think that, like, say, you mentioned Rosa, and I'll come back to Rosa in a moment, but say Demons of the Punjab,
yeah,
which is an episode that follows several episodes later and is basically the same story as Rosa, but much better. And I think that like Demons of the Punjab makes a really strong argument for this idea of kind of witnessing being important, of like seeing something happening and like observing and learning and not injecting yourself in, not yelling about it immediately, not getting outraged over it, observing and just kind of taking on what other people are witnessing. And this idea of kind of, you have the metaphor of the aliens who used to be assassins but have now transformed themselves into witnesses who visit right. The dead before they die. And it's quite eloquent and it's quite beautiful. And I think it's as strong an argument as you can make for like the Chibnall era, like as a piece of television. And again, when I say Doctor Who is less woke, this is exactly kind of what I mean, in that like in the earlier days under Tom Baker, but even straight up through David Tennant into Matt Smith and into Peter Capaldi, the Doctor's MO was to arrive, figure out something was wrong and somebody was suffering, and tear down the entire world
right.
In order to make it right. And this kind of rejects that. And I think when you get to Rosa, you hit the real problem with it. And the problem with Rosa is that the Doctor travels in time. The Doctor meets Rosa Parks and she encounters a situation that if she encountered on an alien world, she would immediately react against and tear down. But because metatextually, because outside of the narrative, we as an audience member understand that this is history, she cannot do that. She cannot obviously change the history that we've lived because it would break the show. But the show can't frame it in that way because it's not clever enough to do that anymore. Mm. It used to be, but it's not anymore. Like, I think of the comparison for something like Rosa is, say, something like Stephen Moffat's Let's Kill Hitler, which is messy script. But the idea of Let's Kill Hitler, which is brilliant and like joyous and like should be the last word on episodes like Rosa. We should not get episodes like Rosa after Let's Kill Hitler. Because the basic concept of Let's Kill Hitler is somebody shows up with a gun, points it at the Doctor's head and says, you've got a time machine, I've got a gun, let's kill Hitler. Because it's the most boring, predictable, generic time travel plot imaginable. And the immediate point that the episode makes is that killing Hitler is completely pointless because this is a TV show aimed at children. You cannot kill Hitler. And even if you could kill Hitler on your TV show that was aimed at children, it would not undo all of the terrible things that Hitler did in the real world.
Yeah.
So you have like a wonderful moment where the Doctor's first response on crashing into Hitler's office is to say, Rory, put Hitler in the cupboard.
Put Hitler in
and
the
like
cupboard.
They just yeah, and they do not mention him again, because like that's the core point, is that you cannot do that. And like throughout, you have this idea of the Doctor there being juxtaposed with the Tesselecta, and the Tesselecta again, outside of being, and maybe again this is another tangent that we could talk about another time, one of Stephen Moffat's recurring jokes about how much he prefers Doctor Who to Star Trek. The Tesselecta is one of the things that happens in the Moffat era where Stephen Moffat is like, yep, Star Trek The Next Generation was definitely a thing that happened and we're going to reference it. So it's like got this kind of bridge crew and this regimented command structure. It's very clearly meant to be like the Next Generation bridge. But the Tesselecta is like the joyless version of Doctor Who. It's a machine that travels back in time and judges dead people. And it basically like tortures Hitler, and it's kind of like wants to make these people suffer for war crimes. And the doctor's like response to this is how insanely unimaginative this is. Like, what a complete waste of time travel. You invented time travel and you use it to torture dead people. That's your big idea. And it kind of like shows a lack of kind of imagination. Again, one of the smaller details I love about Let's Kill Hitler is the TARDIS is a phone box that is infinitely bigger on the inside. The Tesselecta is a robot in the shape of a man, but it's infinitely smaller on the inside. Once characters go inside, they become smaller,
right,
which is a very point of reference. But that's my problem with Rosa, is that basically, if you tell a story like Rosa, there's no story you can tell like Rosa that won't make the Doctor look like a terrible person.
Yeah.
And won't run the risk. And this is where I think the real danger is, because I think kids are smart. I think kids understand that like the reason why she can't change history in Alabama is because it actually happened and the show's not going to break reality like that.
Right.
But I think that as a message and as a metaphor, I think that saying to an audience, when you're confronted with injustice and when you're confronted with racism and when you see people suffering with your own eyes, I think there's value in a show like Doctor Who saying, as it did in the past, your response is to stand beside those people and to use every resource at your disposal to help them in any way you can. And I think that's an important lesson to tell kids. And it's not just like in systemic sense. It's in a sense of like you're in a playground and a kid's being bullied. What do? You interact with that kid. You make the small difference you can make. Actually involving yourself is important. But you look at something like Rosa, and the message that it tells kids is basically, when you see something horrible happening, when you see something that shakes you to your very core and unsettles you, the proper thing for you to do is to stand back and watch it happen and count on the arc of history resolving itself eventually. And like, this is the thing that really bugs me about Rosa, is that like, you have that wonderful speech with Ryan and Yaz. And again, apologies to listeners who have no idea who these characters are because this is a Star Trek podcast. But you have that discussion with Ryan and Yaz where they're like, oh yeah, we both experience systemic racism. Like, Rosa Parks didn't eradicate racism. And that's an important conversation. I'm glad it exists in the episode.
Yeah.
But think about where the episode ends. The Doctor's like, yeah, this was terrible. This was a really horrible experience for everybody involved. But it's okay because Rosa Parks has an asteroid named after her.
and we cast the space racist off into the time vortex to God knows where.
Yeah, like the episode doesn't even like try to connect it to, say, the Black Lives Matter movement that's happening at the moment,
no,
or the kind of kneeling movement or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's like, no. Just so we're clear, we solved racism and now there's an asteroid named after Rosa Parks. So good job, everybody.
Yeah. And that's why Trek.
That's my little vent.
Well, that's why Trek employs allegory, you know, because if it was Frank Gorshin sitting on a bus and one side of his face is, you know, the other and the other, it would be different. But you've made way too many points for me to respond to, so I'll try to bring this together. But I think you've perfectly elucidated my frustration with the Chibnall era, that switch between being an active figure to being, I don't want to say passive, it sounds negative, but, you know, a passive observing one. Building, emphasizing on building and not destroying, because that's what we want. Like, we want that catharsis from our liberal future narratives, you know, kick the door in, you talk the computer to death, you know, you destroy the Daleks, all of them everywhere. And like, in theory, I like what you're describing, but and maybe we can talk about this as we talk about the Star Trek episode, I'm not sure it makes like exciting TV, or at least I'm not trained to want that kind of TV.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, again, I don't think it works. Like, again, the point that I singled out Demons in the Punjab is like, yes, this is the one time that this approach worked. Yeah. And they've been trying it for two seasons now. Like, I understand conceptually why they're doing it. And I understand like why that might be a good idea in terms of changing the kind of structure of the show after so many years. But I also just, I find it really draining and exhausting, because it's not even that thing that you mentioned where you want to watch the Daleks get all explodey, which is great. I also want to watch the Daleks get all explodey. But like one of my big abiding issues with the Chibnall era is that it's not even that it's just kind of passive. It's not even that it's just, okay, she's not going to tear down this broken world. It also repeatedly demonstrates how the world is broken and needs to be torn down.
Yeah.
So she goes to like Space Amazon, where the staff have like, you know, 5-minute breaks where they're watched and they're told to keep moving. And it's very much like exactly like working in modern Amazon. And they don't show characters peeing in bottles. That happens off screen, I guess you can assume.
Yeah.
But like you have this idea that like it's exploitative, it's cruel, it's horrible. It's not a way that anybody would want to live. And then she does nothing. That's a huge problem. It's like that the show doesn't show her fixing broken worlds, but it also refuses to show better worlds as well, which is kind of depressing of itself.
And she thwarts the plans of the guy on the inside to bring down the institution.
Yeah, like she literally says the system is broken, I think, at one point. Yeah, like, I mean, like repeatedly throughout the show, what will happen is, and it happens repeatedly, and it happens very commonly in Chibnall scripts. It's a structural issue with Chibnall scripts. But like, so there will be a terrible human being who is doing terrible things. And as you pointed out, is an allegory for somebody. So, for example, you have the character of Jack Robertson, played by Chris Noth, who is playing a Donald Trump allegory, which is quite clever, given that I think that Mr. Big on Sex and the City was also modeled on Donald Trump, to bring it full circle. I do like that Chris Noth is kind of got the speciality, but like he's operating this hotel in England, and there's giant spiders and lots of people die because of his like immoral business practices. And at the end of the episode, he literally just walks out the door.
Yeah.
Like that's it, that's the end of his arc. And then like later on he pops up again and he does a deal with the Daleks, he sells out mankind to the Daleks.
Yeah.
At the end of that episode, he just walks out the door.
Yeah.
And you have like Lenny Henry playing, and again part of me wonders if this is Chibnall being again a TV producer, and he's like, well, I can bring these actors back and they're big names. But like Lenny Henry playing Daniel Barton in Spyfall, and he's like, you know, he's meant to be like this Mark Zuckerberg figure, but isn't inexplicably a middle-aged man. Like, again, this is one of the things where I get the sense that Chibnall, like, has read a Daily Mail article but has no idea what the world is actually like. Where it's like, yeah, he's a cool, hip tech billionaire who's also in his 60s.
Right.
And it's like, I don't feel like you understand how big tech works, but okay, let's go with that. But like Daniel Barton, who's clearly meant to be like Mark Zuckerberg or kind of Jack Dorsey from Twitter. And he's this guy who's like doing this stuff that's horribly screwing up the world. And like at one point sells out mankind to a ridiculously, literally one-dimensionally evil alien invading force. They literally do not have other dimensions. That's their defining attribute as species. And again, he literally walks out the door. He's giving a big PowerPoint presentation about how he's going to conquer the world, and at the end of it, when it goes horribly wrong, his response is, yeah, tell them to pull the car up out back, I'm going to meet them out there. And that's it, that's the end of his arc. And it's really frustrating. It's really frustrating. Sorry.
Yeah, isn't the Trump one, the first Trump one, he's like, he whips out a .45 and just starts shooting spiders. He's like the only guy that's actually like trying to defeat the monster in the episode.
Yeah, and like there's this really gonzo bit at the end where like the doctor's solution to that problem is to lock the spiders in a room without air where they smother and presumably eat one another as they're doing it. Yeah. And she's like, whatever you do, do not shoot them, you monster, you. And it's like, I feel like if I had a choice between like being locked in a room suffocating and cannibalizing my fellow brothers or being just shot in the head twice, I feel like I'd probably take just being shot in the head twice.
Yeah. The Tenth Doctor drowned all those spiders. He did it quickly, so.
But I mean, to be fair, the questionable science kind of gets you a long way in terms of, like, obscuring the ethical implications of the Doctor's actions there.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Yeah, I just flushed the Thames down to the core of the planet Earth. It's like,
right.
The ethical problems don't even rank in the top 10 concerns with that, I think.
In your movie blog review of this episode, you cite writer Glenn O'Brien as claiming that the exuberant trippiness of 60s sci-fi gave way to the dark bummer sci-fi of the 70s in films like Alien and, I guess, would continue into films like Blade Runner. Star Trek has always carried the torch of future utopia in sci-fi, but do you see positive speculative fiction and utopias as being thin on the ground in the current era?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting because you would imagine that, you know, we talked about how the current political moment perhaps mirrors that of the 60s, where there is that sense of kind of overwhelming information influx. Yeah. And the idea that everything we know about the universe doesn't make any sense. And like all the laws of how people are supposed to behave are being just thrown out the window. And chaos is unfolding as we look out the window. And I think that, you know, you would imagine that that would produce something equivalent to the 1960s, kind of like positive, optimistic science fiction future. Now, I do think, you know, there's a tendency to oversell the optimism of Star Trek. As I mentioned, the universe is something of a charnel house and graveyard. But I do think that, it's kind of interesting that it hasn't, the current moment hasn't produced something like that. Now, I can understand why it hasn't produced something like The Next Generation. I can understand why when you brought The Next Generation back, you had to do it as Picard, because you have to grapple with that. You have to reckon with the fact that the children who grew up in the 90s are not getting the future that we promised them. And that's maybe something that we have to be held account for, and that's something that we have to discuss. But I do find it, I find it interesting that there isn't that level of optimism in terms of science fiction. There isn't that level of kind of hope out there. But then again, I kind of suspect that part of it is also that we live in a generation that is hopefully perhaps more well-read and more informed and more cognizant of kind of systemic issues. I think that that maybe plays a part as well. So like the Amity syndrome, you watch it now and you think of like environmentalism and you think of things like, say, the Gaia hypothesis, which was produced, which was suggested, I think, in 1972. So it was actually a couple of years after that. But I think that you can say that the Gaia hypothesis was kind of like rooted in science and pseudoscience and kind of stuff that emerged through the 60s. But even allowing for that emerging field of environmentalism, nobody in the 60s kind of reckoned with the fact that like climate change was probably going to destroy us in a generation or two.
Yeah.
That sort of stuff. And I feel like, you know, even in the 60s when you had the civil rights movement and that was happening and that was tumultuous and terrifying and horrifying to people, there was also a sense that, you know, we will prevail, we'll come through, that things will be better, that we will fix this once and for all. And I think that, like, when you look at what's happening now, there's a larger sense of no, these problems are larger and more systemic and more deep-rooted, and, you know, we look like we've taken two steps forward but then we take one step back. And so I can understand why nowadays even that kind of cautious optimism of the 60s is harder for us to reach, because I think we understand that, and again, I'm wary of being like too heavily political or kind of like drawing in too much from contemporary culture, but things like, you know, I think we understand that maybe the last 4 years have been tumultuous in terms of like global politics.
Yeah.
And I think we understand that maybe things might change and that, you know, there's been a big shift in terms of what's happening. But I think that now we're not as naive to believe that even though things will be better than they have been for the past 4 years, that they're going to be magically fixed. I think that we're more cynical as a generation, and particularly in terms of like the media that we have access to and kind of the reading that we do and kind of the theories that have entered kind of popular consciousness. I think we're more cognizant of the structural and fundamental problems than we were in the 60s. Because I think at least in the 60s, there was hope that, well, okay, well, maybe if we don't blow ourselves up, at least we'll go to the moon. You know, at least if the Russians don't nuke us, we'll land on the moon and we'll colonize the moon and then we'll launch into space. Yeah, that, like, there's a bright and potential future. Whereas you look at now and it's like, we're probably not going back to the moon. And if we are going back to the moon, we're going back under, like, Jeff Bezos. And it's going to be very much like The Expanse. The Expanse is going to be Jeff Bezos' prototype for what mankind's exploration of the solar system looks like. And that is not a bright Star Trek future.
What really gets me is that with all of the storytelling potential that you have in being able to imagine any universe that you want, maybe it's just the traditionalism of Star Trek, but I feel like Trek has failed to imagine new futures and imagine ways out of this. It was easy when we had the U.S. and the USSR pointing missiles at each other, and we just said, that's not that way anymore. We've got a guy in a monkey's wig on our bridge, so we've got everything fixed. And here we've got something like we've talked about your article about the third season of Discovery before, where Discovery goes to, you know, ostensibly an entirely new country, a new place, you know, the future, the Federation in the future. And the solution to all the problems is just to get everything, get the band back together. And it doesn't really, I think it takes kind of weak shots at proposing, you know, economic problems that need solving and societal problems. But it's basically just, no, if we just remember who we are and get back together, you know, this moment will pass. And, you know, going all along with talking about current politics, I feel like a lot of people on the left, a lot of liberals think the exact same thing. You know, and we don't need to bring Discovery, get them back to brunch. You know, we need to possibly yes. make changes that will need to be made in this new world of the 32nd century. And it's not, and you know, they've got more seasons to come. Maybe they will dive into that. But they were just so self-satisfied with the end of the third season of Discovery without ever really digging into any of the real problems that a character like Osiris was bringing up. I guess it's progress that I think they literally used the word capitalism for like the first time in the franchise.
Wow.
In that discussion that they had, you know, yeah. In the second to last show. But it's not really interfacing with the audience is so much smarter now. I think the audience really is aware of some of these issues and these things. And I think that the show can evolve to meet them, but I'm not seeing that. And then it's even more interesting to consider something like Picard, which is a literal, you know, sequel to TNG, which is taking place on the eve of the 25th century. And it's not really focused on what's going on in the Federation. You know, they're doing this thing. They got to go with Soji and fix the problem with the Flower People or whatever. But the glimpses that we get of the Federation in the 25th century are terrible. Like somebody's got to go to a freehold planet to get healthcare. And all of the Starfleet officers we've talked to are all like mean and bored. And there's just like this giant malaise in the society. And I'm not complaining about it. I think there's amazing story potential there. I want to see things get kind of bad for the Federation, but I don't know if that was intentional or if that will ever really happen on screen.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. To bring it back to kind of the future of Star Trek, that's the push and pull that you see there. And I think this is kind of interesting in terms of the fan base, what the fan base will accept and what the fan base kind of wants from Star Trek. Yeah. Where, like, I mean, you mentioned Back to Brunch. We should be very explicit here. The third season of Star Trek Discovery is basically the argument that we solved, like, the problems grappling with modern American society by electing Joe Biden. It's like, now we can get back to business. You said Back to Brunch. That's exactly what it is. It's like, no. We rolled back the clock. It's like the last 4 years didn't happen.
So the Lincoln Project was the little robots then? Is that I'm getting lost. In the metaphor.
Yeah, but it's very much like along the lines, well, okay, thank goodness that's over with. We can now get back to our regularly scheduled programming. And you're right that it doesn't ring true, because I don't think that a lot of people believe that. I don't think that a lot of people believe that, you know, when the transition happens or after the transition has happened, when this episode is released, that things will suddenly be magically wonderful and it'll be like we're living in the 90s again. And I mean, like, let's be honest, when you lived in the 90s, there were lots of problems. Look at Eastern Europe, for example. Look at Haiti. There were like very serious problems that tend to be glossed over. Things like even within the United States, the criminal justice system, the super predators argument, the fear of like the racist fear of gang violence in Los Angeles and things like that, that colored Voyager a huge deal. But like we tend to gloss over those. And even at the time, we tended to gloss over those and ignore them and not delve into them. But I think that because those problems have all bubbled to the surface and because they become problems that are kind of cancerous and that we have to deal with and confront, I think people are a lot more cynical and a lot less willing to buy the idea that it will be magically reset. And I think that's the thing, is that like the two phases of modern Star Trek are Picard, which I wanted to love Picard, and I love the ideas of Picard, and I loved individual episodes of Picard and individual elements of Picard, because it kind of did what needed to be done, which was like 90s Star Trek was about how it felt growing up, you know, in the 90s, where it was like, look, the Cold War's over. US won. Liberal democracy won. We've reached the end of history. There is no power that will stand to rival our own. We're going to be living in a post-scarcity economy soon. The economics of the future will be quite different, hopefully, if we're living right there. And then smack bang, no, actually, that's not how it works. That's not how it was ever going to work.
Right.
And I think that, like, the best part of Picard is when the show actually confronts Picard with, no, you told us that it would work like this. You promised us that it would work like this. But instead, I'm working three jobs to keep my rent. How do you account for that? Or, you know, you said that, like, systemic racism would be resolved, but we're building a wall to keep people out. We're like, you know, hate crimes are up. They're higher than they were in the 90s. How do you account for that? And I think that those are very important questions. I think, like, it was very brave for Star Trek to want to grapple them. But I think that it suffers the same problem the third season of Discovery does, which is its solution is incredibly trite. Where it's like, oh, no. The Federation will magically rediscover its roots off screen. And Riker will show up at the end and he'll give us our big cheering moment. And Starfleet will be back and it'll just be wonderful. And we can pretend that all this terrible stuff never actually happened without having to unpack or explore it. And it's like, no. That's not how this works. Yeah. You don't get to bring it up and then kind of cram all the worms back into the can and hope that you can just kind of pack it away and hope it goes back to normal. And I think like that's a question that I have in terms of Star Trek fandom, where I think, like, I grew up on Star Trek The Next Generation, as I mentioned. I don't know if you're a similar age to me, but I assume you kind of are. You probably came of age with those shows, would I be right? And I think that for a certain set of Star Trek fan, particularly online, The Next Generation set a template of what Star Trek should be. Mm-hmm. It should be this perfect working environment. It should be this perfectly optimistic future in which characters, as you point out at the start of the episode, don't argue, or at least don't argue bitterly or passionately or aggressively. You know, it shouldn't be. It should be a universe that makes sense and adheres to the rules of logic. And I understand why a generation that came of age watching the Berman era shows thinks that, because to them, that's what Star Trek always was. I kind of look at 2016 through 2021 and I'm like, I'm not entirely sure that that flies. I think you need a new Star Trek for that. And my worry is that, like, I really liked the first season Discovery. It was uncomfortable. It was messy. It was unfocused. It was all over the shop. It had so many ideas and tried to cram them into so little space.
Yeah.
And it maybe didn't fulfill all of its arcs in kind of ways that were completely satisfactory. But it was trying new and interesting things and saying new and interesting things and saying them in new and interesting ways. And I think my big problem with the kind of like second and third season of Discovery, and I know there are fans out there who love them and I'm really glad that they do and I'm really glad that they found an audience. But just for me as an audience member, the problem with those seasons for me was that their solution is let's dial back the clock to 1995. Let's, like, the goal at the end of this should not be to make a new and better Federation. It should not be to interrogate, like, the problems and structural flaws in the Federation that led to, like, even in the 90s, mad admirals coming out the wazoo, or, like, the Dominion War, or, like, the influence that you've had on Klingon politics, which is, quite frankly, not okay, if you look at how much Klingon politics are tied up in the Federation's whims and wangs.
Right.
But you look at things like, say, you know, even Section 31, the attempted murder of the Founders in Deep Space Nine, like, there's a very solid argument to be made that, you know, your goal in Discovery and in Picard should not be to rebuild the Federation as it existed in the 90s. Because, like, Jesus Christ, did you not watch Author and The Measure of a Man?
Yeah.
The Federation and Starfleet is an institution that needs a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have the perfect track record the fans seem to think it does. And think
Picard,
that,
which is still kind of contemporaneous, you know, one little thing on Mars and then all robots must die.
Yeah, all robots must die. And you're like, yeah, but the problem, the solution to that then isn't to dial the plot back. It's to make things better. It's to push forward. It's to try new things. And again, this is, you know, I worry that we're veering too far into politics in terms of this discussion. But there is that sense that you mentioned in terms of like the left and the American left, where it's like, yeah, now it's solved and we'll go back to brunch. Like, we want the Clinton era again. That's what we're reaching towards. That's what we're aspiring towards. And it's like, you look at the world and you look out your window and it's like, I don't think that's going to fly. I don't think that's going to be convincing. I don't think that you're going to sell that idea of a utopian future built on kind of Clinton era exceptionalism in 2021. I think you need something new and something radical and something bold and something adventurous and something out there.
Yeah.
And while I don't think that the first season of Discovery, like, did that perfectly, I think it stepped in that direction. And I think the shows since have kind of retreated from it. I think that, like, having Riker show up with the fleet at the end of Picard was a terrible, terrible choice, because it's like, yeah, we don't need to worry about fixing Starfleet because Starfleet fixed itself off screen.
Right.
And look at things like Discovery, and it's like, you don't have to interrogate, like, what the problems are with the Federation, because, well, we'll just kill the nasty green lady and we'll go back to business as usual. Yeah. It's like, no, that's not how this works. Yeah, that's not how it works. So that's kind of like, that's my, you know, concerns. And I worry I sound like a grumpy old man shaking my fist at the sky.
No, hey, people are used to it. We explore on this show all the time my questions about the underpinnings of the success of the Federation, which, as you mentioned, is fictional. They don't have the answer. And we have to take for granted that their utopia is like their most fictional technology. But I love that you posit in your article about how, you know, the systemic racism that we see against synthetic life forms, all the crazy bad morals, if these are all symptoms of a problem, you know, or if these are elements in the society that proves that we can't all hold it together. And the I know that like unity is a buzzword, of course, right now. And the message of unity, of bringing the entire Federation together at the end of Discovery Season 3 is like, I think it's not only like unrealistic, but it's not interesting for storytelling purposes. When they went to Earth and Earth wasn't part of the Federation, that was interesting to me, because it was like they had always been part of the Fed and now they're not. And it's this idea of why it's easy to, well, as Sisko says, it's easy to be, you know, an angel in paradise or whatever. Yeah. But, you know, it's easy to be the Federation when you're huge and you have 157, you know, member species or whatever in worlds. And it's this whole neighborhood. But like, what if you are maintaining those, your remaining Starfleet amongst other neighbors that you know that aren't doing that anymore? They don't have weird foreheads and pointy ears, and they're not others, you know, they are you, because that's what we have to do every day, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and I wouldn't wear one, but if you wanted to wear a MAGA hat, you're going to get looks. Either you're going to get thumbs up or thumbs down. You know, if I wanted to wear I like comic books, you know, and so if I wanted to wear like a Punisher shirt, I would not intend what a lot of people might assume that I'm trying to say just by, you know, wearing like a Punisher shirt. So we do live amongst the quote unquote enemy every day. And I think that if we want Star Trek to reflect our present in its future, as it always has, like, that's the kind of thing that we need to do, not just sending the Discovery out to just make deliveries.
Yeah. And again, it is a very comforting idea. And I understand why people want to believe that. Like, I understand why the call for unity is, because you want to believe that things can go back to normal, in inverted commas. And when you say back to normal, it's that back to brunch thing, which is that idea of privilege where, you know, a lot of people who want things to go back to normal are people who, you know, had very comfortable lives and didn't have to worry about politics during the Obama era,
right,
as opposed to people who actually had to live with like the horrible stuff that was happening. People, members of marginalized communities, people who were economically disadvantaged, people who were, you know, kind of like facing deportation and things like that, and kind of like facing this sort of prejudice.
Yeah, they've exhausted the stamina of their activism.
It's like,
enough. I upvoted all the Facebook posts and I voted and I'm good.
Yeah, and that's it, I'm done. And I understand, like, the appeal of kind of wanting that, like, fiction as comfort food. And that, I guess, is kind of like, you know, and again, I feel like I'm being unfairly harsh on, like, Discovery and maybe Picard here. But, like, that's the kind of thing for me that is a problem with it, is that I don't think of Star Trek, or I don't think of classic Star Trek as comfort food. It's that thing that we mentioned, like, when we talk about Star Trek as an artifact of the 60s, and I think that, like, the original series is a touchstone. I think the original series is as close to reflecting a moment that's similar to the moment we live in now. It's much closer than the Berman era shows are, and it's probably the one that we should look to as an example of how you could do this. But it's, like, you look at the original Star Trek, and it is a mess of differing opinions. It is not entirely sure how it feels about Vietnam, how it feels about public protests. Right. It doesn't know what to make of hippies. It doesn't know what to make of drugs. It doesn't know if the world is going to end through mutually assured destruction, or because college students are going to brutally murder each other with lead pipes.
Yes.
And like that, and like that, that's uncomfortable, and it's unpleasant, and it's challenging. And I think that, you know, the flip side of that is accepting that every once in a while you're going to end up with a dud like the Omega Glory, which is so terrible and was, like, let's face it, racist in when it aired in 1968. Mm-hmm. But on the other side of that, you're going to end up with something that is beautiful and brilliant and amazing, like The Trouble with Tribbles, mm-hmm. which is like one of the best pieces of Cold War fiction I have ever seen. It's a mockery of the idea of the Cold War between the US and Russia. And it kind of treats it as a joke because it's like, hey, this is absurd and grotesque and the only thing that we can do responding to this is to laugh at it.
Yeah.
And it is kind of like, it is unsettling and uncanny. And again, the immunity syndrome is a great example of this. Star Trek as a horror show rather than Star Trek as a utopian fantasy. And I kind of wonder if you wanted to push the franchise forward, that's probably the direction that you need to be leaning. And again, you know, I kind of mentioned I like the first season of Discovery. The first season of Discovery really captures that. It captures a sense of, like, a universe that doesn't make sense. I mean, people who hate the first season of Discovery joke about how it's a ship powered by magic mushrooms. And I'm like, congratulations, you got the theme of the show.
Yeah.
In that it's very much about consciousness expansion. But yeah. It's also very much about the idea that, as you point out, the enemy is us. The enemy is among us. Mm-hmm. And this idea of, obviously, you know, you have, like, characters who are both human and Klingon. But also even the idea that, like, the Klingon in the Prime universe are actually mirrored with the Terrans in the Mirror universe, who are really just reflections of ourselves.
Yeah.
Like in Star Trek, the Klingons have always been metaphors for the other. They've always been, like, in Errand of Mercy, they were designed as kind of metaphors for the Chinese. You know, in the Undiscovered Country, they're metaphors for the Russians. There were always an external enemy onto which we could kind of, and which, you know, like Americans and kind of the Western world could project their fears and anxieties.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, what the first season of Discovery did, which was a logical extrapolation of that, and arguably building off something that Enterprise did in Judgment, which was to say, no, in the 21st century, what if our greatest enemy is ourselves? What if the Klingons don't stand in for the Chinese or the Russians? They instead stand in for a certain part of the psyche that we all share. And then what if we go even further and we make a Klingon character human?
Yeah.
And what if we go even further than that and we show counterparts of our seemingly heroic, romanticized, ideal characters who are also just twisted and warped in that way, because there but for the grace of God go we. Because as you pointed out, you're living among people who have radically different beliefs, and not just radically different beliefs in terms of, like, yeah, maybe the tax rate should be 25% instead of 5%. More radical beliefs in the sense of, I believe that certain people should not be allowed to exist.
Yeah.
Or should not have their identities affirmed and not have their identities acknowledged and not have their identities, like, expressed and recognized. And that's something that's really terrifying. And I kind of worry about the idea of modern Star Trek, as much as I love 90s Star Trek, and I do. Deep Space Nine is still my favorite Star Trek show. The Next Generation is still my second favorite Star Trek show. I worry about the future of the franchise if it's continually trying to recreate the atmosphere of the 1990s in the 2020s,
yeah,
when the cultural mood is so radically different and the political mood is so radically different and the world in which we live is so radically different.
It's almost like trying to, I don't know if you've seen, as a entertainment critic, I'm sure you have, the WandaVision show recently.
Yes.
But just watching that recently, you know, I was not old enough to really watch those shows, but I caught them, you know, in syndication or at Nick at Night or wherever. And watching it, I was struck by the feeling that, like, this is okay, this is funny, this is, you know, well-made and enjoyable, but why are we doing this? This isn't our world anymore. And if for Trek to try to do what it's doing, it's almost doing that. It's almost, you know, making a Star Trek Leave It to Beaver type show with values that don't reflect the kind of issues and problems that we're facing today. And so just, yeah, you know, now almost 5 years into the CBS Trek, it's not really an experiment. I mean, they're going forward. But 5 years into CBS Trek, I just wish that something would come out that would really do that.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I'm probably a little bit more optimistic than you are in terms of, like, I do really think the first season kind of...
No, I love the first season of Discovery. Yeah.
But yeah, no, like that was kind of like my big thing with the second season, because it was like immediately Pike shows up and it's like the core theme of the first season of Discovery was like, maybe we should interrogate this culture that treats this kind of like roguish, like white male lead as like the moral epitome of kind of like pop culture.
Yeah.
And like you have Lorca, who's basically like, well, what if we took Kirk as a rebel who plays by his own rules to its most illogical extreme? And I kind of love that about him. Like at one stage, like he seduces the Admiral in like very much a role play of Kirk wrestling with the women on the bed in the third season.
And also employing his sexuality, not necessarily for romance or desire, but
as a
weapon,
as a weapon. And like so that I thought that was very clever and very insightful. And then your immediate response to that is to go, oh, but it's okay because the grown-ups here. And it's Pike, who isn't even Kirk. He's the model who predates Kirk. Yeah. And it's like, yep, we've pushed back even further. And I know people like Kirk, and I know Anson Mount is incredibly charming. Incredibly charming. Like, I really love Anson Mount. And I'm kind of looking forward to Strange New Worlds, but it does, even that feels like it's just nostalgia. Like, it's just looking backwards.
Yeah, you know? Well, and an animated show that is just TNG season 8 in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Well, that's enough, I think.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, wow. Oh, no, sorry. I pity the edit on this.
I feel like I've taken a drink from the fire hose, but it's been an enjoyable discussion. Backtracking is back for an all-new season. Hi, I'm Caliban.
And I'm Gooey Fame.
And we'd like to introduce you to Backtracking, the podcast that explores the real-world inspirations behind your favorite episodes of Star Trek.
From historical events to classical literature to blockbuster films, we go where no pod has gone before to seek out the origins of classic Trek tales.
Did you know, Gooey, that the TNG episode Too Short a Season was an allegory for the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah, only sweatier. Did you know that the Enterprise episode Regeneration was an homage to the John Carpenter film The Thing?
Archer and T'Pol freezing to death over a bottle of whiskey would have been a controversial ending.
As a dog lover, Archer would not like The Thing, I'm guessing.
Oh my god, movie night is canceled. Join us every other Thursday for a journey back to the beginnings of the Trek universe.
Backtracking is available wherever you get your podcasts.
No, Porthos!